well, in the early 1900s, an upcoming young escape artist became known as the Handcuff King. And he would do these performances of escape artistry by combining feats of remarkable physical endurance and skill with death-defying escape scenarios. The very first act that he became very famous for was the milk can act. And what, you know, in those days they had those little milk cans. He'd have an oversized milk can, and he would climb into the cramped space, handcuffed with his hands behind his back, and forced into this little tiny space, and then it would be filled to the brim with water and then sealed. And he would have to hold his breath and somehow get out of the handcuffs in time before he drowned. And he became very famous for this, and it was a very, very popular stunt. No one had ever seen anything like that done before. And so, of course, that spawned a series of copycat artists who also then wanted the fame of Harry Houdini, as he was became known, a Hungarian American. And so they started copying Houdini's milk can trick. And this frustrated him to no end, because there was no copyright law governing magic arts. You know, you could copyright a book or a play or something, but not an act. And so these people just kept doing whatever he did and making money off of it. So this frustrated him, but it also encouraged him to up his game. And he continually came up with these new stunts that were more dangerous and more difficult to mimic. And he would eventually do this the stunt, inviting the audience, of course, to hold their breath as well. No one could do that for as long as he could. And he would do it with his feet shackled. He would do it upside down. He would do it in a glass water chamber. Eventually, he would do it hanging from a crane in straight jackets and other remarkable twists that people just found harder and harder to mimic. Incidentally, he did eventually figure out a way to protect his creativity. He marketed it not as a magic act, but as a one-act, one-person play. And he copyrighted that and made a lot of money suing all the copycats that would then do his stunts anyway. And then there was a particular act that people tried to compare him to. Somebody else said that he was as good as this Egyptian escape artist by the name of Ramon Bray. And this Egyptian sealed himself in a tiny coffin and was able to stay in there for 1 hour and 10 minutes. And Houdini then told people, I mean, not Houdini, Bray told people that he managed to do it by using his secret supernatural powers, his real magical powers. And people believed him. In those days, they weren't sure what was magic and what wasn't. And this really bugged Houdini, because he hated it when people said it was real magic. He explained that there was always a trick, an illusion, or a feat of endurance. And so there was speculation at the time of whether Bray was actually holding his breath for that hour, or, you know, controlling his breathing, or if there was magical powers involved, or if there was actually a leak in the coffin. And so Houdini, to show people that this could be done — he didn't believe in supernatural powers at all — he sealed himself in a coffin, and it was lowered to the bottom of a swimming pool at the Sheraton Hotel in New York, and people watched as he held his breath or stayed in this casket underwater, so there's obviously no leak because there's no bubbles coming up or anything, for 1.5 hours, and it came out and just explained, this is not magic, this is controlled breathing. And so he outdid this Egyptian magician, or you can see where this is going. Tonight we see how Moses ups his game to leave the copycat magicians in the dust, literally. So turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 7. Now, last week we exposed the two magicians, Jannes and Jambres, who opposed God's truth by mimicking a few of the miracles that Moses performed. But now the real action begins in Exodus 7. But before we get there, I need to give you a quick crash course that every little Egyptian kid would know from their Sunday school class. You know, you go to a little Egyptian Sunday school class, and they have their flannel graph board there. This is what they would learn. There was no such thing in Egyptian culture as a secular society. In other words, everything in their culture was religious. Everything. There was nothing that was considered, this is religious, and that is geography or biology or science. It was all religious. And they were pantheists. They believed, or polytheists, sorry. They believed in multiple different gods. And in fact, they had a different god for every little nook and cranny of the world that they lived in. A different deity, a different divinity. It wasn't a vague, superstitious system, like a lot of Hinduism is today. It was codified and systematic and sophisticated, and everybody in the country knew all of the gods by name. They studied them, they worshipped them, they revered them, and they knew exactly what they were associated with. From their morning wake-up ritual to the very letters in their alphabet, the gods of Egypt were present and influential. So what God is doing in the next four chapters is not a scattershot shock and awe of random plagues to just explain how powerful he is. Every single miracle he's about to do, every plague that he sends, is a handcrafted weapon aimed directly at one of the Egyptian deities. And in this way, he is going to be dissing the divinities, you know, mocking them, really, showing how ludicrous they are compared to him. Now, just remember, this is quite interesting to me, is that, you know, they had a god, a divinity, a deity over each little, you know, land and water and fire and plants and animals and health and the sun and the moon and the stars, and each one had its own little thing, and yet God is the God of all of those things, isn't he? We sang that, Lord of all creation, of water, earth, and sky. And so God, when Moses says, what is your name, who should I tell him, you know, which God is sending me, just tell him, I am who I am. I am the God who actually exists. That's all you need to know about me. I'm in charge of all of these things, and God is about to prove that tonight. So we're going to have a look at 10 divinities dissed by the true God. Like I said, this year we'll only get to 9 of them. 10 divinities dissed by the true God, so that we will really just appreciate afresh the power of our God and how comprehensive it is. So firstly, let's plunge right into the Nile. The Nile turned to blood. And in chapter 7, and verse 20 is where we pick up the story. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, he lifted up the staff and struck the water in the Nile, and all the water in the Nile turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died. Well, yeah. And the Nile stank, of course, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. There was blood throughout all the land of Egypt, but the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house. He did not even take this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 full days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Now, when I visited Egypt, I got to take a train ride through the land from north to south, and then I took a boat ride from south to north, or as they say, downhill. When they talk of Upper Egypt, it's the bottom part of the map, because obviously the Nile flows down towards the sea, and so I got to see a lot of the Egyptian landscape. And one thing that is very, very clear is that as you go along the Nile, there's about 5 kilometers on either side of the river that is lush and green and productive. There are cities and towns, and there are people fishing and swimming, and there's crops being planted, and there's life. But on either side of that 10-kilometer swath of fertility, there's just desert. I mean, the kind of desert that you go and film movies like The English Patient in, you know, just like as far as the eye can see, just sand, sand, everywhere sand. And so Egypt really does rely on the Nile for life. They need the Nile. And they realized this. They realized that without the Nile, they wouldn't exist, really, in the same way that they did. It was a very powerful nation. It was a very productive nation because of the Nile. And so, of course, they just thought the Nile was a god. They worshipped the Nile. Listen to this hymn penned on a papyrus document which was found dating back to 1500 BC. Hail to thee, O Nile, who manifest thyself over this land, who cometh to give life to Egypt. Mysterious is thy issuing forth from the darkness on this day whereon it is celebrated. watering the orchards created by Ra. Ra, of course, is the sun god. And we'll get to him. To cause all the cattle to live. Yeah, for now. If the Nile smiles, the earth is joyous. Every stomach is full of rejoicing. Every spine is happy. Every jawbone crushes its food. I bet this rhymes in Egyptian, but anyway. O inundation of the Nile, offerings are made to thee. Oxen are immolated to thee. Great festivals are instituted for thee. Come and prosper. Come, O Nile, come and prosper. Yeah, that's not a nursery rhyme. That is a prayer. These people prayed to the river. They immolated oxen. In other words, they sacrificed animals to the river in thanksgiving for the river giving them life. Because once a year, the Nile breaks its banks and the water spills and just causes that belt of fertility. And if the Nile didn't do that, they would all perish. And they realized that. So how do you think the people of Egypt felt when the new god on the block gives their god a blood transfusion? You know, and the Nile is this goopy, stinking, you know, dead fish, a little layer of scab forming on the top, you know, O negative for a whole week. They say denial isn't just a river in Egypt. These people were in denial. And Psalm 65:9 says this. Psalm 65:9, you visit the earth and water it, you greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. Your water, you water its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers, and blessing its growth. God is the God of water. God is in charge of our rivers. God is in charge of our oceans. God is in charge of the water cycle, not the Nile, as God so aptly proved here. So this brings us to the second plague. Now go to chapter 8. You know, the story is that Pharaoh still hardened his heart, and now we up the game to the second plague, the plague of frogs. It's about to get fun in here. 8 verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will plague all your country with frogs. The Nile shall swarm with frogs that shall come up into your house and into your bedroom, speaking to the Pharaoh, and on your bed, and into the houses of your servants and your people, and into your ovens and your kneading bowls, and the frogs shall come up on you and on your people and on all of your servants. Right? Now, I'm not a big fan of frogs. I understand they can't hurt you, what with the distinct lack of teeth. What are they going to do, gum you to death? And yet, there's just something about frogs that just I find pretty disgusting. In fact, today, this very day, this morning, my little boy came and said, there is a frog in your bedroom. And so I had to go to the bedroom, and I get to there, and I see it wasn't a frog. It was a giant spider the size of a frog. And I was actually relieved. Because I was like, okay, good. Spiders I can kill. Frogs, you know, what are you going to do with frogs? Now imagine in your breakfast bowl, in your microwave oven, in your bed. I mean, just wherever you go, and they're jumping on you. And I mean, it's not a dangerous plague. It's just really gross, right? And so God is sending these frogs. I mean, I'm the guy who, I went to a preach at a family camp for a friend at his church, and when I got there, I was totally happy with the rustic, quaint accommodation I had until I realized that my shower had been occupied by a giant bullfrog. And so I went to him, and I said, can you help me get rid of this bullfrog so that I can shower? And so he sent his little boy to do it. Touché, I said. But anyway, so this is a divinity, though, that is being attacked. Okay, this is the goddess Hecate. H-E-Q-T, sometimes K-E-T, it's spelled Hecate. Now the Greeks, when they invented a goddess, they at least tried to make her pretty, you know. They made her attractive to look at in art. Not the Egyptians. The Egyptians made up a goddess, and they would be a little bit more cut and paste from their biology textbooks. This was a woman who was very attractive, svelte figure, slender arms, you know, she was great from the neck down. The problem was the rest of her. From the neck up, she was a bullfrog. And I don't mean that to be insulting. I mean, no, she was literally a frog. She had a frog's head. That's how they depicted Hecate. She was the goddess of fertility and renewal in frogs. Now, generally, when the Nile overflowed, so would the frog population. So you would see it would be easy for them to connect the dots that when fertility and renewal was happening in the land, there were also lots of frogs, and this was a sign that the goddess Hecate of renewal and fertility was a frog-type figure. And so God shows who's in charge of fertility and who's in charge of renewal and new life and frogs. Psalm 105, verse 30 describes this way: their land swarmed with frogs, even in the chambers of their kings. I mean, you could not escape this. Even the king had a frog in his bed. That is the second plague. Then Moses ups his game again to the third plague. Look at verse 16, chapter 8, 16. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth so that it may become gnats in all the land of Egypt." And they did so. And Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff, struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on man and beast, and all the dust of the earth became gnats in all the land of Egypt. The magicians tried by their secret arts to produce the gnats, but they could not. This is the first plague, the first miracle they cannot mimic. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." But Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Now, as I said, Houdini's pet peeve were people that claimed to have supernatural powers. In 1920, he started debunking psychics and mediums by attending their seances in disguise with a reporter and a policeman. And he would kind of mess with them and play with them and expose that they were lying. And he used his background in magic to show what the tricks and illusions people were using to dupe others into thinking that they had real power. He was a member of the Scientific American Committee that offered a cash prize to anyone who would successfully demonstrate supernatural powers. Nobody ever collected the prize. Here, Moses' true miracle leaves the copycat magicians in the dust. As I said, literally, because the dust turned to gnats here. Now, apparently you can train a frog to sit still till you want to produce it. They were able to do that, but you can't train a gnat. Now, the ESV calls them gnats. The New King James Version calls them lice. Some people thought they were mosquitoes. The reason there's confusion is because the Hebrew word isn't real specific. It just means like tiny thingy that bites and itches, you know. So that's a lot of little things. It's just something you can barely see with your eye. I think lice is a good translation because at this point the plagues are all harmless. They only become harmful later, and so I would put this in the category of one of the harmless ones. It's just irritating, the little bites. Now, you've seen, you know, it's just a chilling feeling. You've just had a good day, everything's going fine, and then you look at your little daughter with curly hair, and she goes like this. Scratch, 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 and you just know the next 3 months of my life are going to be spent trying to get rid of these lice. Because once you got them, right? I mean, they're in your bed, and they're on all your kids, and I just get itchy just thinking about them. You got to comb them out. I've heard, because it never happened to my kids. But anyway, I think it was some sort of michi. You know, we call them michis, these little gnats. They're itchy because they're just on you and around you. They don't really bite. Could be a mosquito. The point here is that they were irritating the people, just like the frogs were irritating. But there's something significant going on in verse 17. They did so, and Aaron stretched out his hand with a staff and struck the dust of the earth. And there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats in all the land of Egypt. See, the gnats and lice, or whatever they were, they didn't come from afar, like the locusts would. They came not even appearing out of thin air. The very dust morphed into lice. And there's a lot of dust in Egypt. And it just became these little gnats. Mozzies, whatever. I mean, it would be awful. The Egyptian divinity who ruled the dust and sand in Egypt is a god called Seb, or sometimes Geb or Seb. Sand is a very big deal in Egypt, as I said, because of the except for the 10 kilometers of lush planted area, the rest is just sand, 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 as far as the eye can see. So it's not hard to understand why they would devote an entire divinity just to dirt. There was a lot of dirt that needed to be governed. So with this plague, God is showing that Geb, he isn't even in control of the one thing he gets to be in control of. He's not even, he can't even keep the dirt to be dirt. So it's very significant that the gnats came out of the dust. So we get to the fourth plague, flies. This is one we're familiar with at our house too, because the property next door has these majestic horses that leave majestic little maggot incubators behind. And so in the summer we get flies. Verse 20, the Lord said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning, present yourself to Pharaoh as he goes out to the water, and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me, or else. If you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and your servants and your people, and into your houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be filled with swarms of flies, and also the ground on which they stand.'" Can you imagine having that many flies that you're just walking on them? I mean, it's just gross. And so the Pharaoh begins to negotiate, and he actually suggests a compromise. Now he's starting to learn these plagues can get old. Verse 25, the Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, "Go sacrifice to your God within the land." See how he's now trying to compromise? Okay, I'll let you go do your sacrifices, but don't go out where you want to go, where your God told you to go. Just do a half job in serving him. You can do it, but you must do it in Egypt. And we quickly learn you do not bargain with God. Now, the word here for flies is translated by the Septuagint. Remember, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. That was very ancient. Jesus used that. That would have been Jesus' Bible. And the Septuagint translates this dog fly. That's referring to the ichneumon fly. The ichneumon fly is kind of like a horse fly, except that it bites deep and lays its eggs in the living flesh. So it doesn't look for dead animals like other flies. It actually lays the eggs in you so that the little maggots start eating you. Now imagine a whole house full of swarms of flies everywhere biting you and laying little maggot eggs. Gross, right? Now, the ichneumon fly was considered the manifestation of a particular god called Uatchit. U-A-T-C-H-I-T. You don't want to pronounce that one wrong. But this god was the fly god. And God here, for the very first time, emphasizes the distinction between what he's doing to the Egyptians and what he's doing to the Israelites. In verse 22 of chapter 8, he says this, "But on that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen," remember that's where they live, "where my people dwell, so that no swarms of flies shall be there, that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. Thus I will put a division between my people and your people. And tomorrow this sign shall happen." God is showing that part of the miracle was the ability to keep the flies in Egypt and not in Goshen, the part of Egypt where the Hebrews live. That would be a nifty trick, right? Citronella candles didn't cut it, but God had this line where the Israelites just carried on business as usual, but the Egyptians had these swarms of flies and they didn't go over. Now, the fifth plague in chapter 9, the fifth plague is the death of the livestock. Verse 3, "Behold, the hand of the Lord will fall with a very severe plague upon your livestock that are in the field, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the herds, and the flocks." Remember, by the way, this was their money. This is how you kept money in those days. This is how you invested, is in these herds. Verse 4, "But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing of all that belongs to the people of Israel shall die." So now again, he has this distinction. Now this is an attack on the goddess Hathor. She was a goddess of protection and divine defense. You could call her the minister of defense, as it were, right? She's depicted as having the head of a cow. Like I say, they just kind of did these cut-and-paste jobs. She had the head of a cow, and the point God is making is clear that your God, who looks like a cow, can't even protect her favorite animal. You know, the animal she likes most is the one that's being smitten, and this minister of defense of yours is not able to defend you against me. And notice that God is just going from one aspect of reality to the next. Now he's going for animals, showing that he's got power of the water, he's got power of the insect world, the amphibian world, the mammalian world. And now, in the sixth plague, he shows that he has power of health, of humanity too. Boils in verse 8. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take handfuls of soot. Now notice, now things are, by the way, the plagues are starting to get harmful. I mean, these animals, they're dying. And there's no protection over that because of God is Hathor. Here, the boils are attacking the people, becoming harmful. Verse 8, the Lord said to Moses, take handfuls of soot from the kiln and let Moses throw them in the air in the sight of Pharaoh. It shall become fine dust over all the land of Egypt and become boils, breaking out in sores on man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt. So they took soot from the kiln, stood before Pharaoh and Moses, and threw it in the air, and it became boils, breaking out in sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils came upon the magicians and upon all the Egyptians. And I love that Moses just sticks that detail in, that Jannes and Jambres themselves couldn't even stand up straight in front of him because they're in so much pain. And it boils on their feet, and he's just saying, there you go, magicians. Now, one of the most famous Egyptian goddesses is the goddess Isis. I-S-I-S. No relation to the Islamic State, apparently. Isis was the goddess of health and medicine and peace. Now, it's unclear exactly what's going on with the soot. The priests of Isis used to shave themselves all over, and they were meticulous about being clean, and they always wore white linen. And so it could be that this is an attack on Isis and the priests, because it was this black soot that got thrown up and settled on everywhere. God just made the soot just expand and settle on people and attack them, and they got boils. So the priests in their little white clothes would have now black clothes, and they'd start busting out of these boils. And if you've ever had a boil, it's kind of a nasty sore, isn't it? And it, you know what it's caused by? Lack of nutrition. It's a certain nutrients that are missing in your diet, so it's kind of a sign of bad health when you start popping out with boils. I know that there are other causes, but that's what it's known for. So you can see how this is an attack on Isis. She's the goddess of health, and her and her priests and you know, the Egyptians, and that they can't do anything about this, and their health is deteriorating because God's in charge of that, and she is the exact goddess you would go to fix the problem. But I guess the doctor's not in. Number seven. This is one that the Sunday school flannel graph depictions often call the plague of hail. The seventh plague of hail. But I prefer the plague of fire and ice. And you'll see why. Look at verse 13. Then the Lord said to Moses, rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say, thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and your people, so that you may know there is none like me in all the earth. For by now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. In other words, God's saying there's a very specific reason why I'm not just killing you. I'm doing this to show you how powerful I am, so that you respond. Verse 17, but you're still exalting yourself against my people and will not let them go. Behold, about this time tomorrow I will cause very heavy hail to fall, such as never been seen in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. Now therefore send, get your livestock and all that you have in the field into safe shelter, for every man and beast that is in the field will not brought home, that's not brought home will die if the hail falls on them. Then whoever, now this is interesting, whoever feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh hurried his slaves and his livestock back into their houses. So this is a good test. Now the people are starting to catch on that Moses isn't messing around. This is a real God. He actually exists. And when Moses warns and says, tomorrow there's going to be a hail falling from the sky, and it's going to kill your livestock, and it's going to kill your slaves if they're out in the field, you better get them in. Well, it depends. Whoever believes that is going to do what? I mean, if I told you, I know for certain that in 5 minutes there's going to be the biggest hailstorm anyone's ever seen in South Africa, what is the first thing you would do? You'd get in your car and you go park it somewhere under cover, right? In the middle of the sermon, that's what you do if you believe me. None of you are doing that because you don't think I've got that on my AccuWeather. And you're right, I don't. And so this is the thing. This is a good test of the faith. As the faith of the Egyptians is starting to take root, they're starting to side with Moses. And so some of them went and did that. Verse 21, but whoever did not pay attention to the word of the Lord left his slaves and his livestock in the field. Bad move. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards heaven so that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man and beast and every plant of the field in the land of Egypt. Then Moses stretched out his staff towards heaven. Notice it's Moses now, not Aaron. And the Lord sent thunder and hail, and get this, and fire ran down to the earth. And the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt. And there was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail. Very heavy hail, such as never been in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. Now, hail is not a very common occurrence in Egypt. It's very possible that there were people who had never in their lives seen ice. I mean, think about it. They didn't have fridges and freezers. They didn't have snow-capped mountains. Where would they ever see ice? It never gets that cold. Maybe some frost. But chunks of ice falling out of the sky? There's been some big hail in the past. They've had those hailstones, you know, hailstones the size of a man's fist hammering down on crops and that. This would be like the mother of all hailstorms. Huge chunks of ice and fire. We don't really usually put that on the flannel board, but fire, and people say, lightning. Could be lightning, but there's a Hebrew word for lightning. That's not the word used. Fire running down. Interesting. Now, the goddess of sky was called Nut. N-U-T, but with a little kapiki on the U. So, Nut. Now, Nut had she had an easy gig, because she was not the goddess of rain. She was just the goddess of the sky. Like, she had nothing to do. I mean, the sky just kind of sits there and looks pretty, right? And that's what Nut's job was. And they have different gods for different things. And there's not much she can do wrong, but here she's completely lost control of the sky. I mean, the sky is falling and burning the ground. Number 8, these ones will go pretty quick. We know locusts. Verse 14, the locusts came up over the land of Egypt, settled on the whole country of Egypt, such a dense swarm of locusts as had never been before and never will be again. And they just land and they just eat everything. I mean, they eat absolutely everything. And so plant matter was the last stuff that needed to be put in its place. We've had air, land, water, fire, health, animals, people, you know, now the plant. This is probably an affront on the god of chaos called Seth. Seth or Set. And then the last one that we're going to look at tonight, one that we're all very familiar with in South Africa at the moment, load shedding, the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. Verse 21. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness to be felt. I mean, that's, you've been in the Stadfontein caves, you know, when they turn off the lights, and it's just so dark that you can actually, like, it feels like you're in stuff. I mean, it's just, there's absolutely no light. That's what it was like. Verse 22, so Moses stretched out his hand towards heaven, and there was pitch darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. I mean, that dark. But all the people of Israel had light where they lived. Isn't that amazing? I mean, how do you contain light? And yet God drew a line and said, there's light on this side of the line and absolute darkness on the other side. And I mean, can you even imagine that? Imagine, you know what it's like when you're trying to read and your wife's trying to sleep at night. You know, you just wish there was some system to do this, because she's like, aren't you done reading yet? And I'm like, I've turned down the light as much as possible. Yes, but it's spilling over to my side and into my eyes, you know. Imagine you could just have like a, just this line and keep the light. And it's not possible. And yet God does exactly that. And there's this total blackout. Now, load shedding, or what we had in California when I lived there, was rolling blackouts, which is like a load shedding, except there's not even the hint of a schedule. It's just the blackouts just kind of move around and just kill huge swaths of California at a time. And I read an article today that's the next step after load shedding. If they don't do load shedding, that's what's coming. So be grateful for load shedding. At least send a schedule and sometimes keep to it, you know. But it is inconvenient, and it is dangerous, and it's distressing, and it's economically devastating, but at least it's temporary. At least it's in these little waves. Imagine 3 days of such blackness that you were scared to even get up out of your chair. And who knows what's out there, bumping into people, you can see nothing. It's like being blind. It's like the whole nation suddenly was struck blind. But more than that, who is Egypt's most famous, most powerful god? It's the one that was mentioned in the hymn to the Nile, that the Nile was born from this god. This is the father of all the gods, the god Ra, the sun god, Ra. Well, the sun obviously is a very prominent part of Egypt, and it's very significant that God just switched off the light. Just flip that switch, absolute pitch darkness, there isn't a trace of Ra's power visible. God is just showing that even your most powerful God, I'm in control of what you think he's in control of. And then the 10th plague, which we could really entitle Saving the Worst for Last, is also the most serious plague, the death of the firstborn. We're not going to read it, but all of chapter 11 is a warning of the 10th plague. And then chapter 12 explains the Passover. And for that, you're going to have to come back next year. For now, you need to know this. The point of all of this is to show the world just how powerful God is. These plagues get mentioned throughout the rest of the Bible. And the New Testament picks up on this metaphor that this is the length God will go to save his people. This is how powerful he is, and he is willing to use his power to save his people. And in the New Testament, that metaphor is picked up to show us the love that Jesus has for us and the lengths that he will go to save his people. That he would come, the light into the darkness, and that he would be killed by us and our sins, and that he would live that perfect life, and when we killed him, he would be raised from the dead and conquer that death, and that God's wrath on us would be appeased because it was poured on his own son. His own son. And it was the son of the Pharaoh who died, the firstborn son of the Pharaoh who died, and all the firstborn of all the land, even of the animals, that died. And that was when Pharaoh changed his mind. Because nobody wants their son to die. Right? Nobody. Not even the Pharaoh. Doesn't matter how hard your heart is. That's the last straw. He's done with this God when his son dies. But you know what? Our God sent his son to die on purpose, because he loves you. And the son volunteered to die. The son embraced the cross for the joy set before him, because he can be in a relationship with us for eternity. And that is something worth celebrating and rejoicing over. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we do thank you and praise you for your power. And Lord, when we see it unfolding in this way afresh, we're just reminded again of truly how strong you are and how you have dominion over every single part of our world, and that you're not afraid to use that power to save your people. And so we're so thankful that we are your people. But I pray for anyone here, Lord, tonight who doesn't believe in you, has not bowed the knee to you, whose heart is still hard to you like Pharaoh, that Lord, before things get too intense for those people, that you would save them, that they would come into the light, that they would be on your side, that you would be their father and their protection, so that they would be at one with you instead of at enmity with you. And we thank you and praise you that that is all possible because of what Jesus did on our behalf on the cross. I pray this in his name.